This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. On December 10, 1948, the United Nations General Assembly adopted international standards for human rights. Tonight, 53 years later, we're looking at where human rights stand in the face of the current war on terror. But first, in Tora Bora, airstrikes and the search for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda intensify. Earlier, I spoke with Major Charles Heyman, editor of Jane's Military Weekly. I asked him to assess the military situation in Afghanistan and beyond.
It's difficult, and everybody knew that somewhere like Tora Bora, with its terribly difficult terrain and the hills honeycombed with caves, was always going to be very, very difficult. Now, there is a problem here, of course, because although the U.S. coalition forces are able to attack from the air, there aren't enough of them on the ground, really, to do any more than direct air operations and give some assistance to the Northern Alliance forces on the ground. And with the best will in the world, those Northern Alliance forces don't really look capable of taking that whole Tora Bora complex.
We have a report today that the U.S. military is dropping the Daisy Cutter bombs, these giant 15,000-pound bombs. Can that make a difference on caves as deep as those reportedly at Tora Bora?
Well, probably not. Probably not. I mean, they're going to make some sort of difference near the surface. But when the caves are very, very deep, I think it's probable that at some stage, coalition ground forces, probably U.S. forces, are going to have to be used to work their way through Tora Bora.
Meaning they would have to go into the caves?
Well, you're going to have to clear the caves at the end of the day if you're looking for bin Laden to make sure, of course, that he's not in there or his body's not there or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be a long, hard slog through a complex such as that. And I think that probably the U.S. administration is quite sensibly playing it reasonably cool for the moment just to see how things go. Mm-hmm. And in the long term, if the Northern Alliance troops can't get in and can't do what they have to do, then a decision will almost certainly be made to use ground forces to go in and flush them out and do what has to be done, clear out the cave complexes.
Pakistan has drawn its troops up along the border near Tora Bora. What do you make of that move?
Well, they're trying to seal the exit routes from Tora Bora and the entry routes, of course, into Pakistan. That helps enormously. But when you look at a map of the terrain around there, it is terribly, terribly difficult. And although the Pakistani army can do an awful lot, it's unlikely that they can seal all of the routes themselves. So there is always a chance that people can get out of there. It may well be that the majority of them are out already and that all that there is in the Tora Bora complex is really a holding force designed to delay the Allies getting through and create a diversion so that others can escape.
What's your personal guess about Osama bin Laden, whether or not he's actually there at this point?
No one knows where Osama bin Laden is. My personal guess is that he's a long way away. I mean, if I were Osama bin Laden, I almost certainly would have moved on somewhere else. The last thing I would do is wait in a hole somewhere for coalition forces to come and get me. And he's an important figurehead, and he knows that if he survives for a long time, then his organization will survive as well.
Now, what about the reports we've heard of Marines, U.S. Marines in the south of Afghanistan, at the encampment near Kandahar, on the move? What's that all about?
Well, that's almost certainly they're going up now to seal the exit route from Kandahar. It's a bit late now, probably. We expected them to do it about 3 or 4 days ago. And they're going to join in the hunt for Mullah Omar and, of course, bin Laden if he's in that area. But there's a lot of useful troops there, and they've got quite a lot of support with them. I mean, they'll be able to make a big difference. And, of course, these are troops, again, that you can trust. Of course, you can't trust, really, the Northern Alliance troops to do exactly what they want them to do. So it makes a lot of sense to put your own troops on the ground, and you know exactly what they're going to do and how they're doing it.
They've said they want to round up Taliban soldiers and put them in prisoner of war camps. Why would they want to do that exactly?
Well, they'll almost certainly want to do that to make sure that these Taliban troops don't cause any trouble farther down the line, and also to get useful intelligence out of them. That's one of the great boons that you get from having prisoners of war. So you can interrogate them bit by bit and draw a huge amount of intelligence. But by putting them in camps, of course, it means that they can't operate and they can't destabilize the situation while the interim government is trying to create some stability in Afghanistan.
And finally, Charles Heyman, and very interestingly, the Pentagon has said that the U.S. Third Army, usually based at Fort McPherson, Georgia, is moving its headquarters unit to a secure location in Kuwait. What are the implications of that? The interpretation here has been that they want to be closer to Afghanistan and that they may be setting up in Kuwait as a base for further military operations around the Middle East beyond Afghanistan. Your interpretation?
Well, it gives the U.S. lots and lots of options. It means that they can put pressure on people in the area. Nothing works quite so well as diplomatic pressure that's backed up by military pressure. It really means that you are not exactly threatening someone, but it demonstrates to them that you mean what you say.
But will there be a temptation for the U.S. military to keep right on rolling here, sort of riding the momentum of Afghanistan into Iraq or elsewhere?
Well, momentum is always one of the most important aspects of any military operation. Once you've got the momentum going, you have to keep the momentum going and keep that momentum rolling until you reach the end state where you want to be. It would be very difficult, for instance, to wind the Afghan campaign down and then wait for a bit and then wind up a campaign against somewhere like Somalia or Sudan. So it's quite obvious that the U.S. is going to put a lot of pressure on places like Somalia, Sudan, the Yemen, and these would look to be the initial preparations for actually doing that. Now, whether that pressure results in military operations on the ground in the end, no one knows. I would suspect that military and diplomatic pressure will bring some of these countries to their senses quite quickly. But at least then, the U.S. has the option of doing what it wants to do straight away, without a pause.
Major Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's Military Weekly. He spoke to us from Shrewsbury, England. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights states, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. Today marks the 53rd anniversary of the adoption of those words by the United Nations. In the wake of the barbarous human rights violations of World War II, the Declaration brought a powerful message of basic but often ignored rights. Now, as a new kind of war grips the world, we're looking at the new climate for human rights. Is the war on terror enforcing human rights and shining a light of freedom and dignity to oppressed people? Or does the war on terror and the fear and fury that provoked it put human rights at risk in the name of global security? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now from New York is Ken Roth. He's executive director of Human Rights Watch, a group that operates in 70 countries around the world tracking human rights. Thanks for joining us, Ken Roth.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us from Vermont, our own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie. He's a senior editor with the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
So, Ken Roth, just kick it off right from the top with us. What's your assessment on balance? Are we headed in a better or worse direction in the aftermath of 9/11 and the response to the terrorist attack on that day?
Well, I think that there's no question that human rights are in jeopardy. When people feel that their security is at risk, there is a tendency to overlook human rights constraints and to try to do whatever it takes to fight terrorism. I think, though, that that instinct is very counterproductive, because if you think about what it takes to defeat terrorism, it's first, I think, important to say, what is terrorism? What is it that makes terrorism wrong?
Mm-hmm.
What is it that's wrong about attacking the World Trade Center? Well, there are certain rules in international law that say you don't commit acts of violence against civilians. Those are the laws of human rights and humanitarian law. It is human rights law that distinguishes us from the terrorists. And so if you're going to fight terrorism, you need to build a culture of respect for human rights around the world. That requires paying attention to human rights constraints as you prosecute the campaign against terrorists. And that attention has been waning in various respects, certainly here at home, with the erection of military commissions, but also in the building of the Global Alliance Against Terrorism, and even in certain respects in U.S. conduct in Afghanistan.
We hear this concern beginning to be voiced. Mary Robinson, the U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights, in her message released for Human Rights Day today, called on the world to safeguard against any erosion of human rights standards that might flow as an unintended consequence of measures to counter terror. But what's the bill of particulars here, Ken Roth? We can well understand that in the battle to fight back against terrorists, human rights could get trod underfoot. But what's the evidence?
Well, let's begin here at home. I think that the Exhibit A in the evidence is President Bush's creation of these military commissions. And what he did there was go way beyond the tradition that does exist to use military tribunals in certain limited cases. There is a tradition of using these tribunals against combatants in the midst of a war with applying virtually full due process protections, the protections that are contained in the Uniform Code of Military Justice that the military uses every day in courts-martial.
Mm-hmm.
What President Bush did instead is he, first of all, allowed these commissions to be extended not only against the combatants in Afghanistan, but against anybody, any place who is accused of the undefined crime of international terrorism or of harboring those terrorists. It's a very broad application, and he deliberately omitted any reference to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, meaning that somebody can be picked up, arrested secretly, conceivably tortured to confess, given no presumption of innocence, no right to a lawyer, no right to appeal, no right to even be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and then executed, and we never even know about it.
But Ken Roth, we are told almost every day now that this is a new kind of war, an extremely dangerous kind of war that could be extended into further acts, even including bioterrorism, even nuclear terrorism. In those circumstances, can you, as a human rights advocate, find justification for extreme measures, even the kind of measures that President Bush has taken in this executive order?
The kinds of measures he's taken, frankly, go way beyond the pale. This is not the first time that a country has faced a serious security threat. And the rules of international human rights have been set up to allow certain steps to be taken in time of emergency, but in no case to allow the kinds of transgressions that are being contemplated here.
But what about the rights of the 4,500 Americans who died on September 11th? I mean, that's a pretty definitive end to their human rights.
Oh, absolutely. And so the fact that military action is being used, for example, in Afghanistan against bin Laden and the al-Qaeda network, I don't think people quarrel with that. But what is at stake, if the U.S. government thinks that it's going to defeat terrorism in the long term, it's going to be necessary not simply to wipe out this particular group of terrorists, but rather to defeat the logic of terrorism, the view that anything goes in the name of a cause. In this case, if our cause is defeating terrorism, we have to make sure not to adopt the means of terrorists, not to allow the basic rules of due process, the basic rules that prohibit summary executions or torture, to prevent those from being violated in the name of pursuing this very legitimate goal. If we don't pay attention to those rules, we are, again, using the same ends justifies the means rationale that led the terrorists to attack the World Trade Center and the Pentagon.
Jack Beatty, talk about the razor's edge here and staying on it, especially when the razor's edge is in some ways at America's throat.
Yeah, the possibility of secret cells out there even now planning new acts. It's a very difficult road. You know, the debate, we haven't really had a debate here about what terrorism is. It's been inhibited, I think, by the understandable fear that to understand terrorism somehow is to forgive it. But the notion that it has causes, for example, is almost sort of banned in our thought because we don't see any cause that could justify what happened here. Mm. But as I say, that's a kind of intellectual debility because, for example, we could, on that thinking like that, we could win this battle against terrorism but lose the war. That is to say, by getting in bed and basically endorsing human rights depredations of regimes around the world, we could be supporting the very things that produce terrorism, bad government, illegitimate government, oppression. Someone was quoted in Saudi Arabia, half, I'm sure, mordant humor, saying, you know, if we had politics in this country, perhaps bin Laden would have got into politics. And insofar as we, sidle up to these regimes and you know, blind ourselves to their faults and say, well, we need you in the short run here, we're overlooking what is the long run, which is that the governments in places like that are what produce terrorism.
But Jack, Ken Roth says even in the fight for terrorism, you've got to keep human rights restraints in mind.
I think you do, both because you don't want to set precedents. I mean, for example, on this military courts business, I saw a statement from the Egyptian prime minister saying when we made that announcement, aha, this is the way to defeat terrorists. This is what we've been doing for years, and you've been criticizing us for these military courts. That's just what it takes. Now we're all on the same team.
Mm. We're talking tonight about human rights in the age of a war on terror. Can we have security and human rights at the same time? Can we afford to stand up for global human rights when America is under attack? Can we afford not to? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about human rights in a world after September 11th. This morning, Secretary General Kofi Annan of the United Nations, accepted the Nobel Peace Prize. On this centennial anniversary of the Peace Prize, Secretary Annan said in this new era, the issue of human rights is more important than ever.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have entered the third millennium through a gate of fire. If today, after the horror of 11 September, we see better and we see further, we will realize that humanity is indivisible. New threats make no distinction between races, nations, or regions. A new insecurity has entered every mind, regardless of wealth or status. A deeper awareness of the bonds that bind us all, in pain and in prosperity, has gripped young and old. Today, no wars can separate humanitarian or human rights crisis in one part of the world from national security crisis in another. The rights of individuals, or the right of the individual, are no less important to immigrants and minorities in Europe and the Americas than to women in Afghanistan or children in Africa. They are as fundamental to the poor as to the rich. They are as necessary to the security of the developed world as to that of the developing world.
That was Secretary General Kofi Annan and the United Nations accepting the Nobel Peace Prize this morning in Oslo. His entire speech, by the way, is at our website at WBUR.org. Click on special coverage. We're talking tonight about the war on terrorism and human rights. How do they coexist? Will the U.S.-led war on terrorism create a global lockdown on political dissent? Do we have any choice? Is there a better way? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from New York by Ken Roth. He's executive director of Human Rights Watch, and with our own news analyst, Jack Beattie. Ken Roth, I guess the big fear is here that in our urge, our understandable urge to have some kind of feeling of security, we trample on a lot of rights that have been a long time in the acknowledgement, and people have put decades into trying to support. You say right now you don't think we're headed in a good direction.
That's correct, and I think this is a particularly dangerous moment. First, because when people do feel threatened themselves, they are much more likely to countenance restrictions on rights. But in addition, here, the perception is not that everybody's rights are going to be restricted equally, in which case you could perhaps look to public opinion to set the appropriate balance between security and rights. Rather, I think most people see that the bulk of the law enforcement effort is being directed at young men of Middle Eastern origin, a finite subset of the American population. And so in that case, when only a small ethnic group is being singled out, and indeed only one element of the ethnic group, there is a great tendency for the general public at large to countenance greater restrictions on rights than they would have if they had seen the restrictions applying across the board. So this is a particular moment for leadership. This is when you need people in Washington standing up and saying, we are going to keep the long term in mind. We are not going to push for restrictions on rights that will come back to haunt us later.
Ken Roth,
we're seeing the opposite now.
Sorry. What about a knock-on effect, a ripple effect? There's been concern that, and Jack Beattie mentioned it just tonight, that in the example of the U.S., in the U.S. coalition building and desire to link arms with anybody who can help us fight back the terrorists, we effectively give the green light to tyrants, dictators, anybody who wants to oppress political dissent within their borders, label dissidents political terrorists or terrorists, and no measure is too harsh. Do you see any examples of that emerging, or is that an overwrought fear?
Oh, no, that is exactly what is happening. In fact, just to give you an example, Russian President Putin, within a couple of days of September 11th, came out and said, aha, now you understand what we've been going through in Chechnya. I hope you'll give us greater latitude there, despite the atrocities we've been committing. The Chinese government said, please give us greater leeway in fighting the so-called terrorists in Xinjiang province, where there's a separatist movement. At times, there are claims that have no connection to reality at all, even. Robert Mugabe, the Zimbabwean president, cracked down on journalists by saying that they were sympathizing with terrorists. So this is a big problem. And one of the difficulties is that the U.S. government traditionally had been a voice for promoting human rights around the world, but it now is a voice that, first of all, is not inclined to speak because its first priority is to build coalition partners regardless of the terms. And second, it's almost a stop from being able to speak because if it stands up and says, well, you know, you're stepping too far in the fight against terrorism, a government will come back and say, well, you know, look what's happening in Washington. Indeed, I think we're going to find people just Xeroxing President Bush's order establishing a military commission and using that to set up their own shortcuts around due process standards.
Ken Roth, Jack Beatty, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. Let's invite some in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Connie is on the line. Hi, Connie.
Hi. I have a question regarding when you look back at our history.
That is American history, Connie?
American history, and we look at how our own revolution, and you had Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death, the Jefferson Papers, which promotes anarchy and essentially terrorist acts to affect change. And while I completely abhor the events of September 11th, mm-hmm. how do we as a nation dissect and discern events and acts that promote good change that are for our benefit vis-a-vis events and acts that we believe are promoting bad change? Because mm-hmm. there are a lot of revolutions, a lot of terrorist acts around the world that can be perceived as affecting good change.
That is a tough and urgent question right now, Connie. Thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, what about it? Would America's war on terrorism have made the Boston Tea Party a terrorist act?
I don't think so, but it might well have made the treatment of loyalists in Massachusetts a terrorist act. They were treated, the Tories were treated very roughly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember lynchings, but they were run out of town. Their goods were seized. They were sent into exile. They were essentially ripped off of everything they had. It was a wholesale violation, you could say, of human rights. And of course, look at the history of Israel. I mean, the British were partly forced out of Palestine by terrorist actions performed by people who later became Israeli prime ministers. South Africa, terrorism was part of what the ANC used against the white regime there. And when you look for guidance to the UN, you don't get much. I mean, here is the 2000, I quote from their report, their definition of terrorism. They say, criminal acts intended to calculated to provoke a state of terror in the general public. A group of persons or particular persons for political reasons are in any circumstances unjustifiable. Whatever the considerations of a political, philosophical, ideological, racial, ethnic, religious, or other nature that may be used to justify them. My gosh, that is an amazingly broad definition. And under that, you can imagine a lot of state actions in defense of themselves against terrorism as terrorism. Mm. So the world isn't coming to grips with this. And recently, the UN tried again, and they couldn't do it because the Arab states wanted loopholes for terrorism under self-determination and resisting foreign occupation, which would justify terrorism. Mm. So we don't agree on it. And one man's terrorist does remain the other's freedom fighter.
Yeah,
that cliche is...
Yes, yeah. Ken Roth, come in. Is it your nightmare as a human rights advocate that we wake up fighting the terrorism in a global police state?
Well, let me put it this way. I think that although the UN has been debating for years what exactly terrorism is, there actually is quite clear guidance for how you draw the line if you look at international human rights and humanitarian law. And it's not terribly complicated. The rules are you never attack civilians. You never use civilians as mere tools for violence in the pursuit of a broader political aim. And while undoubtedly there are various revolutionary movements that have done just that, today, I think anybody who resorts to such illicit means risks tainting their movement.
But who's a civilian? I mean, the terrorists are not in uniform.
Oh, no. In other words, civilians are clearly the people, for example, who are occupying the World Trade Center. There's nothing complicated about that.
Yes, but what about Al-Qaeda or Taliban members in Afghanistan?
Right. No, in other words, if there is a war, under the laws of war, one military is allowed to shoot at the combatants of another military. So that's not terribly complicated. And even though they're not wearing uniforms, it's fairly clear who the al-Qaeda units are and who are not in Afghanistan. So this is not to suggest that going to war against combatants is terrorism, quite the contrary. But rather, whether it's in war or in peace, using violence against civilians, against non-combatants, is flatly prohibited. That's where you enter the realm of terrorism.
Mm. Kinroth, stand by. We're looking for the delicate balance, or maybe not so delicate, but the balance between fighting terrorism and standing up for human rights. It may be more complicated than we have thought. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined now by Nina Bang-Jensen. She's Executive Director and General Counsel for the Coalition for International Justice. Hi, Nina Bang-Jensen.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
How do you think Kinroth is painting a fairly dire picture of how we're striking or not striking the right balance between fighting terrorism and standing up for human rights? What's your assessment?
I think it's entirely possible to fight terrorism and stand up for human rights. And I understand the concerns of many, and I share them. We're seeking alliances with some governments that are well known for abusing the rights of their citizens. But it's not impossible to work with governments in the cause of fighting terrorism, because after all, the cause is a very good one here.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, not holding back in criticism of them, not holding back in our support for independent media there, or linking with human rights groups on the ground.
But Kinroth is expressing considerable skepticism about the path that we're on right now, saying the Bush administration has taken things too far. What's your assessment?
I don't see it the same way. I can understand the risk, and I certainly see the possibilities, but I don't see that the U.S. government, as Ken said, which is traditionally a voice for human rights around the world, has really changed that dramatically in this short period.
What about the military tribunals and President Bush's executive order? Those are particularly of concern to Kinroth and others. What do you feel about them?
Oh, they're of concern, as written, they're of concern to me as well, and should be concerned of many citizens. But they were and are, and that's why people on the left and the right have combined to asked the Bush administration to narrow them, and there seems to be at least promising indications that they are going to be narrowed. My own view is that military tribunals in a very narrow context are perfectly appropriate. There's precedent not only in U.S. law but in other Western democracies for doing just this. I mean, it's far better to have a procedure to handle high-level, and I would say only high-level people who are engaged in acts of war against the United States as unlawful combatants.
Mm-hmm. And how do we aggressively pursue a war against terrorists who, after all, are a threat to lives in many countries without giving a signal to dictators that they can clamp down on any dissident within their borders as a terrorist?
It is very, very tricky, and Ken is quite right. I mean, people from Putin to the government in Yugoslavia to others around the world have said, now's my time to say I'm on the side of the U.S. and I'm going to, you know, or to say, look, now you understand the problem we've had with these terrible Muslim terrorists for years. And that's what we have to guard against. But I think it's possible to do that, to maintain true to our principles, work with governments, but retain our right to criticize them and withhold support when we need to.
We're talking about balancing the war on terrorism with standing up for human rights. How do you think we're doing? Will the American-led war on terrorism give a green light to global human rights abuse, or will it provide the necessary security for anybody, everyone in the world, to have human rights? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Steve is on the line. Hello, Steve. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A quick comment, and I'll listen to the response afterward.
Okay.
I think your guest, Mr. Roth, is it?
Yes, Kinroth.
I think he's instilling fear for our civil liberties in the minds of your listeners, and he's clearly putting himself in the line of the terrorists. He's a friend of the terrorists, and vis-a-vis Ashcroft's testimony the other day before the committee, this man should be carefully looked at and possibly imprisoned.
Well, Steve, but let me just ask you, is it possible to raise this issue without being an ally of the terrorist?
Not the way he is. Not in my opinion. I mean, the way I'm listening to him, he's putting fear in the minds of the Americans. And Ashcroft said right there very clearly, you do this and you're a friend of the terrorists. You're aiding the terrorists. You're abetting the terrorists. This guy's, you know, he's doing what Ashcroft said he's doing, and he should be, you know, put under maybe military court. This guy doesn't deserve civil rights.
Steve, we'll put your observations straight to him. Kinroth, what about it? Steve says you're a friend of the terrorist in the way in which you stand up for human rights. Is this a criticism that human rights advocates are now hearing?
Well, I should say, I mean, Steve appropriately pointed to Attorney General Ashcroft as the source of that observation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Ashcroft was utterly irresponsible in making that kind of accusation. He basically said, if you question our judgments about civil rights and civil liberties, you are aiding the terrorists. And that is the worst kind of McCarthyism. That is basically to say that, you know, we give up on free debate, we give up on our democracy, we just trust Ashcroft to do the right thing. And that is so antithetical to the American way. I can't believe that the American people want to subjugate their rights, their hard-fought liberties, the entire Constitution, to the whims of one man. That is just not the American way in any sense whatsoever.
Do you have any sense from your organization's work of where public sentiment stands on this? Are you seeing more or less support for Human Rights Watch since September 11th?
Actually, we have found intensified support for Human Rights Watch because people understand the desperate need for us to do what we're doing. They see it in this country where we need to make sure, as Nina Bunn Jensen says, that at minimum the Bush administration significantly cuts back these military commissions so that they're only used in the way that they've traditionally been used against combatants in time of war, using the Uniform Code of Military Justice, not this wide-open tribunal with virtually no procedures. We're needed to make sure that when Putin says, you know, let me do my thing in Chechnya now despite my atrocities, that we push the U.S. government to say no. The fight on terrorism needs to be a principled fight that affirms human rights, not violates it, because if you're undermining human rights principles, you're undermining the very standards that separate us from the terrorists. Mm.
And Nina Bunn Jensen, what are you seeing in terms of this new environment of fear in which people understandably live and its consequences for support for human rights?
Well, you know, I have great faith in the American public. I think they're very sensible. They know that what's at stake here, or really what we're battling for, is open societies, for the rights of individuals to make their own choices. And it's they understand that in this context, that we are battling against a group of terrorists who would take that choice and have taken that choice away from lots of people. So, I'm confident that people will understand that we're not going to give up our the things that our soldiers are fighting for right now, our respect for individual liberties and freedom of speech and freedom of association.
Nina Bunn Jensen, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Nina Bunn Jensen is Executive Director and General Counsel for the Coalition for International Justice. Jack Beatty, you heard in our caller's comment the echo of John Ashcroft, who's been very tough on people who cast doubt on the way the government's pursuing the war on terrorism in any respect.
Yes, he has. And, I agree with what Ken said. I mean, I think that was to essentially say debate over policy is giving the enemy aid and comfort. I mean, that would then the alternative is silence. And what a great statement of Americanism silence is.
Hmm. Listeners, we're talking about human rights and the war on terrorism. Can we have security and human rights? Can we afford not to have both? What kind of world would that be? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the very real challenge, suddenly urgent, of balancing a war on terrorism with a commitment to human rights. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Owen is on the line. Good evening, Owen.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just one point I wanted to make. During this the last few years, and particularly if you look back in history, one mm-hmm. of the interesting things that seems to happen, particularly when you run into a situation like this, is that the tougher governments have clamped down on terrorist organizations, the more dangerous a lot of these terrorist organizations have become, and it seems like there's almost an inverse relationship to the amount of oppression, mm-hmm. you could say, that is, you know, brought down on these organizations.
But Owen, what's the alternative to toughness on Al-Qaeda?
Well, I think it's fairness, really. I mean, there's really two pieces to it here. You've got a short-term initiative, which is, you know, taking care of, you know, immediately sort of finding out where terrorists are and clamping down sort of on the illegal activity.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a long-term initiative in terms of, you know, finding the root causes of these problems. And a lot of times, the root causes are, you know, things like poverty, unemployment, general hopelessness in the population.
Owen, thanks for your call. Let me put this to Ken Roth. Ken Roth, what about the kind of circumstances of poverty and hopelessness that Owen describes? Not being in poverty is also a human right, isn't it?
Yes, but I think Owen makes a good point. I mean, obviously, if you're talking about pursuing actual criminals, then the government should be as tough as possible within basic rights restrictions. But I think the point that Owen is alluding to is not the prosecution of al-Qaeda, but rather if you look at a country like Saudi Arabia, there the government is corrupt, authoritarian, largely indifferent to the welfare of its people. And in order to avoid a democratic challenge to its continuing rule, it has simply prevented the emergence of any civil society, any political parties, any independent media. And in that circumstance, if you are unhappy with the government, which many people are, you are driven to the radical extreme. The lawful channels that ordinarily one would pursue to try to change the government's policy or even change the government are blocked. And it's in situations of oppression like that that extremist groups like al-Qaeda thrive.
Ken Roth, our time is running down, but put this fall and your concerns this fall in a little perspective for us. How were you feeling before September 11th about the general progress globally on human rights?
Well, one of our great concerns prior to September 11th was the unilateralism of the Bush administration, its unwillingness to countenance the kinds of international treaties that are needed to bolster human rights. And we saw this in its blocking of efforts to enforce the Biological Weapons Convention. We saw it in its scuttling of negotiations to try to restrict the flow of small arms and light weapons to abusive regimes. So those were already concerns. Ironically, since September 11th, the administration has had to reach out to a global coalition, but it hasn't really changed its tune on international human rights law. For example, just a couple of weeks after September 11th, the administration actually endorsed legislation in Congress that would impose sanctions on governments that ratify the International Criminal Court. That is, the Global War Crimes Tribunal that once established would be the best place to try people who commit acts of terrorism and to try to deter future.
But the U.S. has not been willing to cooperate fully or to commit to using that court.
No, it basically says we'll support this court as long as we can exempt Americans from it. And needless to say, the rest of the world doesn't view that as universal justice.
Ken Roth, it sounds by your lights you've got your work cut out for you. We thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Ken Roth is Executive Director of the Human Rights Watch. Jack Beatty, it's amazing how in the short span of these conversations, we almost always get the full range from the caller's concern that this is aiding and abating terrorists to Ken Roth's concern that we're slipping backward on human rights.
Yeah, I think the polls show the public generally supports a hard line, but within every person there are these conflicts. No mm-hmm. American can regard the growth of unanswerable state power as an unmitigated good. It's it tolerate it as a temporary evil, perhaps. We're a freedom loving people, and so the kinds of authoritarian makeshifts that we may need, or at least our leaders seem to think we need to get through this crisis, are against the American grain. And so people, even if people in general support that, I think if you confront them with particular policies and with aspects of those policies that could darken their own lives or the lives of their children or the lives of people they know, then they take another view. We don't trust. The idea that we should put our trust in government is not what the founding fathers thought. It wasn't trust that was going to keep our governors just. It was the other branches working against the other. And that's what we should put our trust in.
Well, we're being asked to give a lot of trust right now, but then the threat is severe, too. What a time. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Since the events of September 11th, we've been asking many people on many fronts how this tragedy came to be. Enter the Project for Muslim Understanding. 6 Muslim PhD candidates from across the country have come together to analyze the global trends within Islam and beyond it, which contributed to the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Their goal is to increase understanding in America of Islam and in the Islamic world of its own traditions and current circumstances. Joining us now is the director of the project, Joseph Lombard, who's currently a PhD candidate in the Islamic Studies Department at Yale University. Good evening, Joseph Lombard.
Good evening. How are you?
Well, thanks. The first thing to ask about your Project for Muslim Understanding, why was it formed? What's the mission?
Well, the Project for Muslim Understanding was actually formed as a smaller part of the Islamic Research Institute.
Okay.
The Islamic Research Institute was in the works before 9/11 came about, but then when 9/11 came about, this catalyzed it. We felt we had to strike while the iron was hot.
And to do this, you've brought together a half dozen Muslim scholars in the United States, some from overseas and some American Muslims.
Yes.
Why do you think it's important to pursue this in the context of American culture, as you say?
Because there are now over 5 million, some say even close to 10 million Muslims in America, and we as a community are at the point where the Catholics at one point found themselves and where the Jewish community at one point found itself, where we need to build intellectual institutes whereby we can more fully participate in shaping the American dream and the American discourse.
You are Muslim yourself by birth or by conversion?
I'm Muslim by conversion. I converted 8.5 years ago.
And what's the subject of your paper?
The subject of my paper is the decline of education and the rise of ideology in the modern Islamic world.
You have said that that decline has been so precipitous, so serious, that it's led to a myopic understanding not only of Islam, but of modernity itself. Explain that.
Since the middle of the 19th century, Muslims have been trying to come to grips with their relation to the Western world, which clearly had more power. This has resulted in several reactions. One is the basic reaction to try and continue with the traditional modes of Islam. Another has been what I would call the modernist approach, wherein many Islamic thinkers have given up on the intellectual traditions of Islam and have adopted many Western ideologies, so that you have people who say Islamic Marxism or Islamic socialism or Islamic democracy, but they're not looking at it and really understanding what exactly are the ideologies behind Marxism, socialism, or democracy.
So how might we see this at play in the terrible events of this fall?
Well, this is a very interesting question. To understand how that thinking is in effect in the events of this fall, one needs to see that the fundamentalists are actually a very modern movement, and they are the flip side of the modernist coin if one wants to speak about the current intellectual, shall we say, milieu of the Middle East.
What do you mean by the flip side of the modernist coin? The fundamentalists present themselves as defenders of the one true traditional faith.
Yes, they do. The way in which that one true traditional faith has been defined has been by throwing out the intellectual traditions of the past 1,200 years, intellectual traditions which were designed in order to apply the principles expounded in the Quran and in the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad to the new exigencies of life which confronted Muslim communities as they expanded in the world and as they encountered new forces from the world.
Joseph Lombard, I want to take you right to the points that are on so many people's minds lately. There's been a lot of discussion about Islam's apparent failure to come to grips with modernism. Are you saying that this is because it has lost their traditional respect for learning that was part of Islamic culture?
Yes, exactly. There's a wonderful saying by C.S. Lewis. He said, once you have rejected a part of a religious tradition, you have ipso facto rejected the entire tradition. And this is what has happened to a great degree within the Islamic world, that there are several groups, and I'm not doubting that some of them have been sincere, but I do believe that intellectually they have been misguided in rejecting important components of the Islamic intellectual tradition. While these components were opposed by other people and other thinkers in the past, nonetheless, those thinkers had to read the thoughts and had to take them on seriously as a part of their intellectual milieu. In this day and age, they are rejected out of hand.
The Prophet Muhammad said, seek knowledge from the cradle to grave, which would be, must have been a spur to a lot of the great Islamic scholarship that occurred centuries ago. But now when we think of higher education in much of the Islamic world, it seems filled with dogma and non-scientific thinking, and you're saying not even with good Islamic thinking.
Not even with good Islamic thinking, no. See, in Islamic thought, it is divided into two general categories. One of these is called transmitted sciences,
mm-hmm.
and another one is called intellectual sciences. Now, the transmitted sciences refer to things like your prayer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't sit down one day and figure out that you need to pray five times a day,
mm-hmm.
or that you need to go on Hajj once in your lifetime. So these things need to be transmitted to you. And this is the realm of Islamic law. But when it comes to articles of faith, one can't be taught to believe. And now, in this effort to make dogma also a transmitted science rather than an intellectual science, this has contributed to the intellectual stultification of the entire Islamic world.
Joseph Lombard, you've spent a long time thinking about this. At this point, we're trying to look for solutions here. How, then, can the thought leaders of the Islamic world be pulled back in line with the older traditions of inquiry and insight that were so much a part of earlier Islam?
Well, one thing is that they have to come to grips with some of what's happened, and there are thinkers who are already doing this. Among them is Dr. Seyed Hossein Nass at the George Washington University. There's also a gentleman by the name of Naqib al-Attas in Malaysia. And in Iran, believe it or not, there has been a very strong dedication to this tradition, which, however, has been somewhat subjugated by the current governmental structure.
Why are these voices, though we have spoken to some of the men that you just mentioned, but overall these voices are very little apparent compared to the angry voices that have been so much in the news. Can that be changed somehow?
I think that can be changed. Unfortunately, however, that involves some change in what the media looks for, because there are many Muslims, in fact, the majority of Muslims, who would very much like to get back to the full, vibrant intellectual heritage that Islam once had. But these people are people such as myself, who tend to have an organization like this and work with other scholars and work very closely with people in the Islamic community to start creating ways in which we can all do this together. And we're not seeking the limelight. We're not seeking press, because our main objective is to make this happen and make this a reality for the members of the Muslim community whom it will nourish.
Joseph Lombard is the director of the Project for Muslim Understanding. He's currently a PhD candidate in the Islamic Studies Department at Yale University. Tomorrow, as part of our week-long series, we talk to another PhD candidate about his paper, The Myth of Monolithic Militant Islam. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our